Lisa was a quirky young girl. She was a close friend of mine when I was growing up in California. And she told me that when she was a small child, she used to like to walk through the cemeteries with her older sister. And they would stop at the different tombstones and read the person's name and dates of birth and death. But that was not enough for my friend. She would ask her sister how these people had died. And her sister would make up all sorts of dramatic stories of accidents and rare, horrible diseases. "Oh, Lovey," she would say, because that was Lisa's nickname, "that poor girl died in the influenza outbreak of 1918, and she was fine when she woke up and gone by sundown." I grew up in California, and all the cemeteries I knew were wonderful, beautiful, rolling hills of gardens kind of cemetery. So as strange as it sounds that someone might like to walk through a cemetery, they were beautiful parks, well kept, very quiet, not much traffic. So when I went to Boston for the first time and saw some of the old cemeteries associated with some of our older congregations, I was a little surprised. They are small and crammed full of headstones. It is difficult to walk between the headstones without walking on somebody's grave, something I was told as a child you were never supposed to do. What I only found out recently is that our Unitarian forebears are the people that we can thank for the transition to the Garden Cemetery. Much of my research for this sermon comes from a podcast called The Pamphlet, which is a podcast on Unitarian history, Unitarian Universalist history. Listen to it if you get a chance. It's really good. So back in 19th century Boston, it is said that most people crossed the street so they didn't have to walk past a cemetery because they were just these loathsome places for people to go. So how did we get from the graveyards full of scary images to cemeteries, places where one might want to take a walk or even have a picnic with one's sister? The roots of this transformation can be traced back to a Unitarian in particular and Unitarian thought starting around 1825. You see, the original Puritan burial grounds were meant to be places that were upsetting and disquieting. So, of course, the most common headstone was the very narrow Boston granite that was often inscribed with a skull. The grounds themselves were deliberately unkempt. The whole point of a Puritan burial ground was to make you contemplate your future judgment. And of course, inside the Puritan theology, that meant contemplating not only that your fate was completely uncertain, but it was also very likely to be an unhappy one. You can see this theology reflected in the way the cemeteries were designed, but also in the actual headstone. So this picture is actually a picture of King's Chapel in Boston, their graveyard at King's Chapel. You can see how the headstones are all crowded together, and this is after it has been tidied up for us 21st century folk. And if my technology works, another Boston graveyard. The markers are practically falling over each other. Not really a welcoming place at all. And this is an example of what would be found on a gravestone marker. Early Puritan headstones, if decorated at all, tended to have skulls on them. It certainly added to the sense of scariness and seriousness about what might happen in the afterlife. That threat of hell. But in Boston in 1825, population was exploding. There were so many people there that a problem came to be where they had no more places to put bodies when people had died. There was just no more space in Boston city limit. They were trying to figure out a way to deal with this problem when also there was started to be a change in how people thought about death and the body. Transcendentalism was beginning to take hold, and it was having its impact on how people thought about the relationship between life and death. And remember that transcendentalism had such an emphasis on finding the divine in nature. If you go to Boston and you go to some of the historical sites, especially around Cambridge, you'll see signs for the Mount Auburn Cemetery. I actually have never been there. I always wondered, why are there so many signs to Mount Auburn Cemetery? For one thing, it's very big, but it is also historic. Mount Auburn Cemetery was actually thought of by Jacob Bigelow. He came up with the idea of the cemetery as early as 1825, although it took about five more years until it was established. He was concerned about the unhealthiness of burying all these people in Boston and sometimes under churches, and the idea of running out of space. So he proposed that on a plot called Mount Auburn, which is outside of Boston, near Watertown, that they would build a rural cemetery. It was to be a cemetery in which that Puritan vision of decay and mortality would be challenged, and a new chapter reflecting this emergent, Unitarian, liberal belief that death was not the end, but a natural part. He believed it would be represented there. He said that the rural cemetery was going to be a place for the living as well as the dead, where family values and the endurance of the family was to be celebrated. He wanted to create a place where family members would go and visit their deceased loved ones in a space that felt comforting, in which trees and flowers and birds and animals would be present and provide consolation to the soul. And I think he succeeded. This is called the Dell. It's a small lake, a water feature at the very center of the cemetery. And here is a picture of a tree-lined walking path. And even when you see headstones of graves, they are set against the breathtaking landscape of tree and bushes. It is a place where you would want to go to commune with nature, a place that doesn't create fear and does not celebrate death, but instead, by the very way it was designed, communicates the connection between death and life. Mount Auburn was created as this innovative way of trying to unite life and death and to provide comfort to those who were mourning. Mount Auburn Cemetery was revolutionary in its time. The establishment of the cemetery solved a problem for Boston, where to bury people when they were running out of space. But it also helped to bring into American thought, a different way of looking at death. The transcendentalists and the Unitarians moved to a place of understanding that death is one part of the arc of life. It is sad, for sure, but it is not something to be scared of, and it shouldn't be used to control people through fear. If death is a natural part of life, then we should be able to be around it and even celebrate it just a little bit. The pagan holiday Samhain is said to be when the veil between this world and the next is at its thinnest, and that the connection is most easily felt, and when the connection is most easily felt. Mount Auburn Cemetery was created to live out that close relationship. It was revolutionary at the time, and our liberal Unitarian faith helped to make it possible. I have a paradoxical relationship with my ancestors. My family of origin map, sometimes referred to as a genogram, is complicated. I suppose everyone's is, in a way, but mine in particular. You see, I'm adopted, but I was adopted with my twin brother. So I grew up in a family both with a blood relation and non-blood relations. And I got all sorts of questions, the kind of questions that adopted kids get. My least favorite was, who is your real family? And where are they? I never knew as a young child, when people asked me what my ancestry was, which family I was supposed to answer for, because I had been told what my birth family's ancestry was. So was I supposed to say English, Irish, Scotch, and Dutch? or French Canadian in English. I didn't know. To further complicate things, I grew up in a house built on property that had been owned by my family since my great-great-grandfather established it as a farm in 1871. I was surrounded, literally surrounded, by artifacts of my ancestors, who I knew to be my real ancestors, but who many people questioned as my real ancestors. Did you know, for example, that you cannot be a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution unless you have a direct bloodline? If you are adopted, you don't count. So there I was, surrounded by a cloud of witnesses, my ancestors, but always with this nagging question, were they really? So yes, ancestors are a little complicated for me. It did, however, often feel like there was this cloud of witnesses, cloud of ancestors surrounding me. There were stories of dangerous travel and perseverance, or adventure and discovery, of family and stability. All these stories became like guiding lights for me. Some were positive stories told so that I could learn to be like my ancestors, and some were negative stories reminding me which ancestor not to be like. I was told about my great-great-grandfather, Oliver, who traveled from Montreal, Canada, by boat to Panama, then crossing the Isthmus of Panama by foot, catching another boat, and traveling up to California for the gold rush. That story taught me that it's good to take a risk, and that often there is a lot of hard work involved with risks. My father would tell me stories about how the original farm had been bought by my great-great-grandfather. It was in hectares, I knew that. And how his great-great, or my great-great-grandfather, did not want his son to grow up to be a farmer. His son was also named Oliver. And so my great-great-grandfather worked hard, saved his money, and sent his son to school again. Hard work and commitment to family. My great-grandfather became a doctor, and to do that, he had to ride his horse approximately 15 miles, and if any of you have been to the Bay Area, he had to ride them over the Berkeley Hills, which most people from out here look and say, what is that mountain? They're very tall, and to ride a horse over it must have been a little tough. He did that so he could catch the ferry to San Francisco, where he would spend the week in study, only to do the return trip on the weekend. It taught me that commitment to a project is important. These are only some of my ancestors and some of my stories, and I won't bore you with them all, but these were passed on to me. One of my supervisors, when I was training to be a therapist, a family therapist, once explained his view of ancestors and their effect on us. He said that ancestors are like the stars that we guide our ship by. It's like this. You know, you grow up and you have your parents with you, or some parental figure, and they guide you and protect you and travel with you and teach you about how to be. And then one day, they are no longer by your side. They have moved from this world to the world of the ancestors. But they are not gone. They don't disappear. They move from your side to a place in your heart and your mind, and they are with you always, looking over you and guiding you still. And the stories that you have about them stay with you, and you pass them on to the next generation. And they then become the guides for that generation, just as you and I will someday. My family has this long line of Olivers, and they all stand behind me, helping me do what I do here this morning. Samhain is that holiday that honors the ancestors, just as we have honored our ancestors here with our altar. Starhawk said it this way: in Northern Europe, Samhain, the Celtic term for Halloween, was the time when the cattle were moved from the summer pastures to the winter shelter. It was the end of the growing season, end of harvest, a time of thanksgiving, a time when the ancestors and the spirits of the beloved dead would return home to share in the feast. Death did not sever one's connection with the community. People would leave offerings of food and drink for their loved ones and set out candles to light their way home. These traditions gave us many of our present-day customs. Now we set out jack-o'-lanterns and give offerings of candies to children who are, after all, the ancestors returning in new forms. Death and regeneration are always connected in goddess theology. Birth, growth, death, and renewal are a cycle that plays over and over again through natural systems and human lives. Embracing this cycle, we don't need to fear death, but instead can see it as a stage of life and a gateway to a new form of being. So Samhain is a time to remember and honor those who have died, to celebrate their lives and appreciate their gifts, to tell stories about them to the next generation so their memories will not be lost. Samhain was not a holiday I celebrated as a child. I grew up Roman Catholic. Sure, we did the Halloween thing with trick-or-treat, but in my Catholic family, the stories were of ghosts and ghouls and how much candy did we get. My first year working in a UU church as a DRE, the schedule of the year had been set for me, and so on the appointed Sunday, I got up before the children in chapel and talked to them of Samhain. There were a few giggles, and one very kindly adult gently and quietly told me that it was actually pronounced Samhain. Those Celts spelt everything differently. But I have grown to deeply appreciate this holiday, even though it was not one of my childhood. This time to appreciate who has gone before me, and to consider who will come after me, and to recognize that as the ancestors watch, I am living out their hopes and dreams, and you are too. Death is never easy, but the beauty of Samhain is that it helps us remember the deeper meaning of the holiday, that death is no barrier to love, and every ending brings a new beginning. In a world without end, I know this to be true.